And so that's where I became interested in the care management side. And then that kind of fast forwarded into, we do a lot of special needs trust work. And it was very hard, because that is a protective proceeding, to completely separate any kind of care management aspect with the trust administration. And so that was my journey. And that's why you see me talking about capacity, because it's something that's near and dear to my heart, because it has such implications to the client. And sometimes I think it's easy to be a little casual, and all of us in that sort of vulnerable adult elder care space, I know I've been guilty of it before, when I've been way too casual about saying somebody has capacity or somebody doesn't have capacity. So that's where I'm coming from, and the implications of making that decision, how we make that decision, and what some of the ethics may be involved, because certain people may want you to say one way or the other way. So there's how you can reach me if you want to reach me. And then I just had one other slide to get us kicked off, and then I'm going to leave it to you. So the questions in my mind are, what is capacity? You know, I mean, we can look it up in the dictionary and get a definition. Are there different kinds of capacity? Think about what people are expected to do in their daily lives. What can they do, some of them, but not all of them? What about assessments? Who decides if somebody has capacity? And finally, what are the ramifications of saying somebody lacks capacity? How does that reverberate in their world, particularly when it's not so black and white? So, all right. So who wants to tell me what they think are different kinds of capacity? I'm going to unshare this, hopefully. Doggone it.
I think you just need to close it, probably. Or there should be at the top, it should say unshare screen or stop share on your screen at the top.
Maybe that's it. Yep. Okay. Got it. Now I just have to, there you guys are. Perfect. Okay. So does anybody want to start off with what they consider are the different types of capacity?
Mental, physical.
Okay. Okay, so what are some examples of mental?
Well, with regards to diminished capacity, like somebody who might have dementia. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so the diminished capacity, what are the symptoms you see? How do you decide that might be an issue?
Is this for me or just for everybody to jump in?
I'm hoping everybody's jumping in, but they're so quiet. I didn't bring coffee for everybody.
I'm sorry. I'm like, throwing it out there to create some combo, so I don't want to hog up the conversation.
No. And I know you guys are super smart and super experienced, so I know you have opinions on the topic.
Well, one would be a physician diagnosis following an evaluation.
Okay. And how do you feel about some of those physician diagnoses? What kind of a physician?
Neurologist.
Okay. Do you ever see some quick diagnoses made that might make you feel a little uncomfortable?
Now you can't get us to be quiet.
No, exactly. Yeah. Go ahead, Amy.
I think that's something I come across a lot is people are trying to scramble to get a capacity determination made. And it's really hard to figure out who's the doctor that knows this person the best, right? There might be a neurologist that's better, you know, skilled, more experienced, but if they don't actually know the person as well as their primary care doctor, I'd feel more confident in getting the letter, getting the determination from the primary care doctor.
Amy, sometimes though, I'm sorry, Byron.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say real quick that from a legal definition, it can vary state by state.
Mm-hmm, very so, much.
Yeah. In Texas, any doctor, but only a doctor, not nurse practitioner, not a social worker, only a physician can determine capacity.
What about a neuropsychologist? Can they do their battery? No. Wow.
They can give a diagnosis, but it will not stand up in court. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I wanted to say something about the doctor. So I've noticed here in Georgia that while the primary care doctor is oftentimes the person that, you know, does the mini mental and things like that, sometimes that primary care doctor just says Alzheimer's. Oh, they have Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. But that's not really the case. So oftentimes it's truly the neurologist that can tell us because of that MRI, because of that, those data points. So that's just what I've seen here in Georgia.
I agree with that. I think though that's more relevant to the issue of diagnosis than actually determining capacity, because those exactly. two concepts are different.
Right? And I think the determination of capacity is so intimidating to the doctor. Yes, diagnosis, I'm so comfortable with that as a doc, but now you want me to project that diagnosis onto their capabilities. I don't really know them from a capacity viewpoint. I'm not at their home. I'm not looking at their checkbook. I'm not looking at their family dynamic. I'm just saying, here's a diagnosis. And so I find such hesitancy from the doctor to actually make the statement that not from the diagnosis goes to their capacity.
And I might get sued, right? If I'm the doctor.
Exactly. And so they back off and they're not willing. And we're in the background saying, but I do see them. And let me tell you that they are not capable of, you know, an executive function all the way down to fixing a piece of toast. I just give you the diagnosis. I got to get out of here.
Very mm-hmm. much. Prachi, am I saying it correctly?
Yeah, Prachi. Yeah. Okay. So I have been an occupational therapist for last 25, 27 years now. And and again, I'm very new to this CMC profession, so to speak. So I'm learning from you guys today. But what we do as an occupational therapist to determine capacity is we do something called the Allen Cognitive, which is a very, very comprehensive test, which is done, and it is done with three different modules and stuff like that. So that is one thing. And then a quick screening is the SLUMS or the MoCA and stuff like that. Those are the ones we do to screen. And then if there is a detail needed, then we do the Allen Cognitive. And I think that gives a very true picture of what the person is capable of. It gives to the point that gives you a number, like 3.0 might mean that they need supportive services, and 4.0 might need supportive services, 4.4 might mean that they are independent, or 4.2 might mean that they are assisted living, you know, type
support.
So we are very specific in those areas.
So Prachi, how do you feel about the primary care physician performing a mini mental and then making a diagnosis?
I'm a little bit leery about that, again, because it's, you know, it is such a quick thing and you cannot get a whole picture of, you know, what the mental functioning is with that small mini mental. I've done mini mental in the past as well, but we had to stop it because it requires, you know, you have to purchase the mini mental so often and stuff like that. So that's why we had to stop using it. But I have permissions to use MoCA, and I have permissions to use SLUMS.
Mm-hmm. So here in Wisconsin, the definition of incapacity is the inability to take in new information and process it to make one's own healthcare decisions. I have many clients who have a diagnosis of dementia, but are still very capable of making their decisions. So, you know, I don't believe that the diagnosis alone renders incapacity by any means whatsoever. You know, but I've been at doctor's appointments with clients where they can fly through that mini mental when the doctor does it, or they talk a good talk, and then I have to say, but you know, there was that phone scam in which she lost, you know, $20,000, or you know, the medication management has become very challenging. You know, so that's where I too, Prachi, I'm an OT by background, so I always bring up the functional abilities. But here again, there's still a difference between functional abilities and mental capacity, because people can have that rote function, but not the mental capacity to make the decision. So sometimes it can be a fine line, but You know, I use the slums or MoCA also, but I also really focus a lot on function because I think that's really where the capacity comes in.
And so, Sue, you really hit two great hot buttons. One was the executive function and the decision-making abilities, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. some of the tests don't flesh that out, obviously, and they may right. look really good. And I mean, I don't know about you guys, but sometimes when I know I have a high IQ person in front of me, it's really a challenge, quite frankly, because they're so good at covering up.
right.
And I get it. Nobody wants, you know, they're using their compensating skills to be able to do that. So certainly on the executive function, which really tends to impact finances, that's a right. huge thing. And what do you think about levels then, you guys? So Sue has mentioned this concept of, particularly with respect to healthcare, but then also brought it into the, possible elder abuse, financial abuse. What do you think about different levels within it? Can you have capacity to do something but not another thing? And what would be an example?
Again, I would go back to, was it directed to Sue? I'm sorry. I don't want
to start today, anybody. No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Again, I would go back to the Allen Cognitive. Sue, I'm not sure if you've used it in the past or not, mm-hmm. Allen Cognitive Test. Mm-hmm. And that kind of is quite specific about, you know, new learning, executive skills and all of that. So it kind of gets into the very nitty gritty about all of the details.
So let me give you a case study then of somebody that was in my office the other day. I had a phone call from Merrill Lynch because they had a call from this woman who says, TD Ameritrade has just kicked me out. They won't service me anymore. I'm not a client. And so she calls Merrill Lynch and says, will you be my broker for me? And these guys were smart cookies. They didn't just say yes immediately. And they started to ask questions and they found out that her accounts were frozen and so on. And they found out, they only found out the tip of the iceberg actually, but there was a couple of people working together that were presenting a type of, I don't know if you'd call it sweepstakes, but basically if you do X, you'll get this money, but you have to send me your money first scheme. And this woman sounded like you guys. I mean, she really sounded good in so many ways. What was going on, do you think?
It's hard for me to say. Like, again, I'm, you know, don't forget I'm learning and I'm very new to your field.
Yeah.
So, but I'm...
Yeah, well, Meryl thought I had the answers, Raja. I'm like, oh, I meet with her, but, you know...
Right. I mean, you know what problem. I would... Yeah, what I would do is, like, I would sit with the lady, whoever this XYZ person is, and, you know, get to the bottom of why TD Ameritrade in the first place closed the accounts, number one. You know, why would that happen?
Yes, and I got consent, that information. She had given them about $1 million over time. So I got that answer. She had given them about $1 million over time. So I got that answer to these people.
Mm-hmm. So those scammers were in it for the long haul. You know, there is something, mm-hmm. a bit of a manipulation that can happen, even with our, you know, our clients that do have capacity, they can still be manipulated. And there are some real clever con artists out there. And if, you know, I mean, if they're in it for the long haul and they develop that relationship with someone, it might not be about capacity if they're manipulated. I don't know. That's a hard one.
Yeah, I have she was a professor, very, very highly, educated. And, you know, she was a professor at the university, a chemical engineer, by the way. So, like, you know, super, super smart. Yet she is being scammed of her money, and she has been educated about it, and she's, you know, a lot of her friends have told her that what she's doing, but she is being manipulated, and I did not know that she was being scammed until she asked me for money, and she was a friend, of course, and you know, she asked me for money and I gave it to her, And then later on, other friends called me up and said, Prachi, don't do that because this is where she's losing her money. So that's when I realized it. So yes, you can. That is an absolute concern for a lot of our seniors, where they are many a times making poor decisions. And I'm not 100% sure that, because that is a psychological piece, I think, because psychologically, you know, they are, it's like a dependency on a particular, you know, whether it is a relationship, addiction, whatever you want to call it. And so this particular situation, she was gambling, so to speak, you know, it was a more like a online gamble.
I love that word. Do you think, do any of you think that greed entered into it?
For the actual, like.
Yeah, you know, I just have to send in 20,000 more and I'm going to get 800,000 or whatever.
Absolutely.
It was.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Frozen.
Right.
I think so too. I think there's all the other psychological parts, but I think she was hoping that it would be true.
And it's so common. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think this is where, again, we as the psychosocial side of the equation bring so much to the table. You know, with a financial scam and capacity, we have very empirical data. They had this many dollars. They were scammed out of that many dollars. That's very categoric. That's very clear, et cetera. When we have less empirical data in that regard, and we see an individual, a perfect example, I had a client who never had any children. She had squatters living on the property. And her answer to every injustice was, I never had children. These are the boys I wanted to have and I never had. So whatever they want, whatever they need, I'm going to give it to them, even to my detriment. Did she have capacity? Again, very bright, very capable. She flew through those assessments that we do because she was so bright. A federal librarian. You know, very bright. But she was making poor decisions, supporting squatters to her detriment. And it was very difficult until we got, I tried to feed all the psychosocial side of it to the doc, but until we got to the point where she was at a detriment because her dollars were diminishing, they wouldn't be there for her in the future, were we able to find someone to agree that she did not have capacity for her own well-being. She was doing harm to herself. Not to others, but harm to herself. And so it was a pull to try to get attention regarding this alert, verbal, intelligent person who was sliding down a slippery slope. Very frustrating.
How do you think executive function, or lack thereof, or impaired executive, or diminished, how do you think that might impact healthcare decisions? What do you see? What do you see, Gail?
I think we see huge. Again, I'll go back to this client of mine. Doctor put this client on oxygen 24/7. The squatter felt she didn't need oxygen. She needed a humidifier. So he recontoured the oxygen concentrator into a humidifier.
Oh, dear.
And she said she felt better. Could have been the alcohol he was delivering to her every hour on the hour as well. And so, you know, pictures of the device he contoured, she could not see the forest for the trees, that there's COPD, emphysema, pulmonary issues. But boy, that humidifier, I can buy you a darn humidifier. Let's keep the O2 going with a cannula in place. But again, this executive function, well, he really wanted to do this. He really needed to feel like he was the hero. Those are all really empathetic statements to her demise. And so getting her in a position to understand that her executive decision-making in these circumstances was not to her benefit. But it is such a slippery slope with physicians, again, because here we come in, articulate, bright, clear, and not sensible. And is that a judgment on my part? Could be. Did she have the right to make poor choices? She did. Did she understand the consequence of those poor choices? I don't think so. Nor did she want to. And that's a differential as well. want to, can, very different elements.
I'm dealing with one of the doctors right now. It's amazing, you know, Gail, you bring up a very good point. Currently, I have a doctor who I'm, you know, trying to help with his wife. And wife has some kind of dementia. It's a very unique disease. And, you know, she's in a some research study and all of that. And I have observed the wife. She is making poor decisions. She's making, like, you know, in so much so that she's going to be falling one of these days. Her, you know, gait pattern is not the right, best gait pattern. She's using a baby stroller instead of a walker because she's denying to use a walker. So all of the, you know, signals which you can imagine that are looking like right at you and saying, okay, she's making poor decisions. Yet the husband, who is a physician and a psychiatrist, if I can add to that, he's not able to see it. And he is allowing her to make those poor decisions. And I'm like, oh my God, now if a psychiatrist is doing this, how do I convince him that you are making a wrong decision?
What about, Prachit, I like what you said there about that, because, you know, this psychiatrist, you know, you would think that they would be a good ally, good advocate.
Yes.
So what about in the case of, you know, where a fiduciary is allowing someone to make poor decisions and allowing someone to, you know, buy their caregiver an RV or things like that. These are supposed to be competent people, but they see that individual as, you know, having capacity. So then they allow them to make these bad decisions. I don't know. That's another tough one.
I know. And it's a tough one because it's almost like, you know, I'm seeing it that, you know, this lady is going to fall and break her hip one of these days. And she's relatively young and it's going to be a devastation to the nth level, you know, to the family. And I've tried to convince the doctor. He has been to my office. I have been to his home and everything. And he's still, you know, I think it's many a times it's the, emotions which get in the way of family members making the right decision. And that's probably why doctors are not allowed to treat their own family members. And I'm seeing that very clearly right here in this situation, where even though it is true and clear that she's not making the wisest decision, he's not stepping up and saying, okay, Mrs. blah, 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 you need to do this and this. And I'm going to take the decision and I'm going to step up and, you know, make the right decision for you. That's not happening. It's emotions taking over.
So what are some strategies that any of you have used to overcome the circle of support in terms of being more assertive on these issues?
Well, sometimes we try to loop in, like if there's adult children or grandchildren that can become allies if the spouse is the one that's in denial. Oh, we try to loop in, obviously, the grandchildren or adult children that are willing and definitely see the problems. Trying to do a mini intervention, if you will. I mean, sometimes that's helped. Sometimes it's backfired. But, you know, you have to check the box that you've at least tried. So if you can find an ally, it could be a neighbor, a friend, somebody in that immediate circle, that has proven to work. And again, it has not worked, but we always try to start there. We can look for a close ally within the circle. Maybe it's a professional, another professional.
Jennifer, I ran into a problem with that, looking for an ally in a situation where the fiduciary, you know, this couple, very, very, very wealthy, had no family. So there was a fiduciary that used to be their insurance agent. And so I was looking for another ally. And these people, you know, they gave out money to tons of different people in the community, and even a judge, they gave scholarships to the judge's daughters. So, you know, when we did our intervention and I was looking for allies, the situation that arose was confidentiality. You know, I can't approach this judge and be like, hey, listen, you know, you're the probate judge. You know what's going on. you know, I mean, obviously I wouldn't approach it that way more professionally and try to see where they're at with it. But yeah, the confidentiality aspect, you know, you can't pull in the neighbors. You can't, it, you know, because then you're violating confidentiality. So I don't know if you've run into that, Jennifer, or not, the confidentiality aspect of trying to pull in resources and supports, or if anybody else has.
That was going to be my question too. You know, how do you, because I have to like think about also HIPAA laws and all of that, because I come from the clinical background as well. So I don't know, like, that's what I'm going to look for answers from you guys.
Right. Well, so in this sense of a circle of like the adult children or grandchildren, they're typically the caller wanting to hire us to do the care management. And so it's, you know, I'm not going to go out and solicit an ally, if you will. It's somebody within that circle, and the information that I disperse out would not necessarily violate HIPAA, right? So again, you do have to tread lightly on the information that is dispersed and who's in that safe circle. But often it's not the spouse in denial that's calling us for services, right? It's typically the adult children or the grandchildren. The spouse and the client never realize they need us.
So. They're disconnecting the phone when the call's made.
Exactly. So it's, you know, we're brought on sometimes by the adult children or grandchildren. And I use that because that's pretty typical, as, you know, sometimes it's a friend of a friend. We're not even called a care manager, right, at that time when we first come in to even meet. So we have had to get creative. It's like when you at times have to introduce a caregiver. Sometimes they're not a caregiver, they're the personal assistant, right? Or they're the daughter's best friend. I mean, that is sometimes how a caregiver has to be introduced to allow a caregiver into the home. And again, we're not it's not the actual client who's calling for caregiving services or care management services typically.
But Jennifer, go ahead. Sorry, Brian.
To Jennifer's point and to Prachi's point, which is, and we're not HIPAA, by the way, Prachi. I mean, we're very clear that although I'm a clinical social worker, the services we provide sit just outside of HIPAA. So I love it, but we do have confidentiality issues. And so, you know, I would hope that, you know, our letter of agreement, even though the adult child is almost always the person that calls and contracts with us, our client is always the senior or the adult with a disability. And so we have to get their permission to loop in the circle. I mean, and we tell the adult child, you can hire us to care for your, to help with your parents. But if your mom tells me not to talk to you, I still expect you to write the check every month, but I'm just not, but I won't be allowed to talk to you. So looping in people can be difficult. And we have to have client buy-in. Of course, back to the capacity issue is, if we feel they lack capacity, but there's no formal, interventions yet, I think that's where the tension comes in, is what is our role? Normally, right, we're supposed to advocate for what the client wants, but if we know that it's a terrible idea, are we supposed to impose our judgment? Right. And I don't have an answer to that, so I'm just going to leave that hanging there. But that's the hard part, is I think sometimes we have this beautiful plan in our mind. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is situation 2L4, right? This is exactly like every, you know, some other client that I've had, or mixture. And I know I can see the plan exactly if everyone would just buy in. But I can't make them.
And we have to confirm that who has power of attorney over health and finance, right, before we take on a case. So often it's the adult child or grandchild that may have the power of attorney, or the, so that obviously is all put into place, right? So,
right. But like in Texas, a medical power of attorney is springy. So it's not that, I mean, you can't make decisions
right
until the person's been declared invested.
Thank you, Byron, because I see that so often in California where they show this power of attorney, but it's a springing one.
Oh, we have it all the time in Texas. Oh,
forget
yeah.
It.
They're like, well, I'm the power of attorney, so you can talk to me. And I will tell you, the medical field is so baffled by it. They're like, oh, okay, well, you're the medical.
Oh, they believe it every time. Yeah.
So I'm going to just going to tell you everything. Like, oh, no, it hasn't sprung.
Right. No.
Yeah. Okay, can you please clarify? I'm not understanding. I thought I'm from the medical field, I guess. So that's why I'm like thinking power of attorneys, everything. So, you know, I just kind of go with the flow, I guess. So maybe I'm wrong. So
It varies so much from state to state, though. You know, as far as if they're springing, here in Wisconsin, a healthcare power of attorney is not springing. It needs that finding of incapacity that has to be signed by two doctors or a doctor. But some financial powers of attorneys are written to be springing, but it's usually only when the attorney writes them as such. So
What is springing?
Springing means they're immediately effective. So, you know,
springing means that there has to be some activity that, so I can write a financial power of attorney that's springing that says on June 1st, my wife can sell the house even with my name on it. And so June 1st is the springing event. So, or I can write a power of attorney that just says, right, my daughter has power of attorney, financial power of attorney to do everything for me from now forward. So she can just go out and sell my house starting today. But in Texas, a medical power of attorney, the person has to be declared incompetent by two, not incapacitated, but unable to make medical decisions, incapacitated to make by two doctors. And so then the medical power of attorneys becomes in effect. But lots of people try to put it, well, I'm my mother's decision maker. Well, you're not yet because she's not incapacitated.
I'll take it one step further.
A HIPAA release where I can say my doctor can talk to me, mm-hmm. your doctor can talk to me because of the HIPAA release. But that's not a power of attorney.
Yeah, and I can, in California, even if the medical power of attorney is it's active, right? So whatever it took, it's active. That does not mean that you can force medical treatment on somebody if they do not want it. So if they don't want medication, they can refuse it. If they don't want a certain procedure done, one of my more interesting examples was a woman who had been in a car accident. She was relatively young, in her 30s. She had had, he'd been sexually abused at one point, and she did not want to have any kind of gynecological exams, even though we suspected there was a tumor, some sort of abdominal tumor, but it would have meant having this investigated. She had every right to do that. And that was actually under guardianship, which would be even stronger. So what I find offensive, particularly among people that hold these powers of attorney, is they think they can force everything. You know, I'm going to make you take your medication. I'm going to make you go to this specialist and do this procedure. Or I'm not going to let you do this procedure. You don't want that, Mom, because it's going to be painful. You don't have all that control. We have to allow a certain amount of dignity and control over their own destiny for these individuals. And sometimes it's even when it may not be in their best interest. Like my example, the woman, you might say that was not in her best interest because she was avoiding medical care. But when you take in the social psychological part of it, maybe it was in her best interest because she was avoiding something that was very painful to her. So it's not absolute control.
Leanne, I have a question for you.
Yeah, Abby.
So as a fiduciary, you know, with this case I kind of briefly talked about, that same fiduciary, you know, he's, and I'm not on this case anymore, but he instructed the caregivers that if the client, husband and wife, if the wife falls, instead of calling 911, they call him and he determines whether they call 911. That's why I'm not on the case anymore and other reasons.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. He had no right to do that.
Exactly. And so, but the husband who is of capacity, who is technically supposed to be making those decisions on behalf of his wife, very neglectful of his wife, doesn't get her birthday presents. Anyways, he lets this, you know, fiduciary do this. And so you know, since you're the fiduciary on the call, you know, what would you recommend to, and I'm not on this case anymore, but what would you recommend as far as reporting this fiduciary? I mean, is there anything that we can actually do?
Well, I think, I'm assuming you're a mandatory reporter in your state. I would have called Adult Protective APS Services. Whatever, you guys don't have that? Okay.
No, we do, but it's not an APS appropriate case.
I get it, but I think I would still create the paper trail to report
it. We did.
Nothing's going to happen. I get that part. Yeah. But I still would, want to bring light to it.
Yeah.
You know, while I could see that happening here, mm-hmm. and if for a non-family member to do that, they're really risking a lawsuit, but obviously that person wasn't worried about that.
There's no family checking in, you know, it's just this.
Yeah. Just this one person.
Abby, was he a licensed fiduciary or was he an insurance person acting within fiduciary, like a fiduciary scope? I'm confused.
So he's a CPA and he met them years. This family has so much money, multiple trusts, right? So he just spends their money like crazy. Met them years ago as their insurance agent and they liked him and adopted him. So kind of like what, who was saying that earlier about, Gail, about, you know, adopting these people, you know, so he's sort of their adopted son kind of thing. He has an active CPA license and I reached out to the CPA board and they were like, well, we can do this and you'd have to go to court and you'd have, and all this kind of stuff. And it's just like,
and you would not have standing to go to court. So it's very hard to crack these. I don't have an answer. People get away with some pretty rough stuff.
Yeah.
And not
well, letting them.
And they're letting him. They have the right to make that choice. And we love our CPAs, but one of the things I'm really noticing this year is that a lot of CPAs want to take on the fiduciary role. It's kind of a product extension and they're asked, sometimes they're begged to by people, but they're not really trained for it. And so I'm seeing a number of, not necessarily catastrophic mistakes like what you're saying, but things that just aren't, they just don't know. You know, it would have been done differently if they'd known. So I don't have an answer, Abby. Bad things happen to people that don't set up the right situations. And I have to say that sometimes, which makes people very angry, but I had a guy yesterday, he doesn't want a care manager. He doesn't want an advanced healthcare directive. He has terminal cancer. He just wants me to take care of his money after he dies. And I said to him, how am I going to know when you die? You know, who's going to let me know? And he had no answer. That was kind of a rude question, wasn't it, Gail? But I mean, how am I supposed to know? And so he just, like, he could be so vulnerable to this kind of thing. Right now he has capacity and he knows what's going on, but you move that needle a little bit. He's a perfect example of someone who's purposely isolated himself. And this is what you get when you don't have a big circle of support of various ages, not just your contemporaries. And they didn't pick a good guy. Sad.
That's why I think it's very important as lab care managers when we do our assessments. The assessments are probably very essential in trying to determine who the social network is for them. We've had two or three, I would say, in the last month that are single elders, no children, but they trust their attorneys, perhaps. They, you know, are working with other individuals or trust officers, whoever. And so when you talked about strategies, I think that's one of the things that we kind of try to look at is who is their social network, but truly a support system, not just a contact for them. So we try to establish that.
You mean it's not just a phone number, Mary? I couldn't even get a phone number for this guy.
But I have a client right now who is borderline capacity. And so I deal with primarily with his healthcare, who is long distance. And I'm actually starting to question the capacity of the power of attorney. So I've putting everything in writing instead of calling him. On conversations, he gets very gentle and like angry and upset about totally weird and inappropriate things. So I kind of reports in writing by email so that I feel like, number one, I have it documented, but that I feel like he's more likely to process it, because otherwise he doesn't listen or hear me. I don't know that he's understanding me. So that's getting to be a real challenge for me, that I'm kind of scratching my head, telling myself something doesn't feel quite right here. But, he's had a lot of health problems, so I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt to get through his own health issues. But, yeah, that gets to be a scary situation also.
So I'd like to throw out one more. Whoopsie, I'm muted. So sorry.
Now
you can. Yeah, funny. Yeah. Kept showing me a thing saying I was muted when I wasn't. So I want to touch on or emphasize what Byron said, and because I thought he wove in the ethical aspects so well. And if I paraphrase you, Byron, correct me if I got it wrong, but you mentioned the idea of if the senior, the elder, the person that we're servicing, if they won't let me talk to you, or I think the other part of it was if they won't let me do certain things, then I have to, you know, I have to listen to them because, you know, they're the person, and that's what our code of ethics touches on. So I'd like to present as a corollary to that, then, why would certain people within their circle want to pressure all of us to have the decision of, or the classification of capacity or no capacity? What are some of the agendas that they might have that they might use to try to influence you guys?
Definitely financial. I mean, that's usually the number one agenda when someone is trying to influence, you know, they want money out of it. You're muted.
Exactly. I'm trying because my office is noisy. Okay. Do they want capacity or do they not want capacity?
You mean the
financial, the person member that wants money? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They don't want them to have capacity. Okay, they don't want the person to have capacity because they want to make decisions. Or maybe they do want the person to have capacity so they can blame it on the person and say, well, you know, that person told me to do it, which I guess that's maybe the case of the, yeah.
Interesting. I would argue they want the appearance of capacity. And so
yeah, that's right.
If I can find somebody who's incapacitated or that I can manipulate, but I can present them as capacitated, which is why most abusers isolate, because they can't. It's really hard to get somebody to present as capacity when they clearly don't.
Yeah.
And so, if I isolate you, then nobody knows.
Yeah,
I'll take all of Mrs. Jones's phone calls. She's sleeping. So.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So, what about Johnny? Johnny's lived with Mom for 25 years. And hasn't held down a job during that time. And Sister Sarah is really upset. And she wants Mom to kick her out. Who wants capacity and who doesn't?
Well, I think that's a really good example, Leanne, because there we go back to family dynamics, fear. You know, I'm sure the son, Johnny, is hanging on by a bitter thread there, because change of capacity changes his life. You know, he's likely, you know, with Sister Gail, who says she knows it all and wants to, you know, take over and get things right. Johnny is saying, you know, you're changing my life too. And so capacity can be pretty intimidating. Why don't we just let things be status quo? It's been working. Why are you needing to jump in here?
Mom wants me here and I take care of her.
Exactly. I think it gets pretty, you know, the dynamics. If it's an outside influence, I absolutely understand the greed potential, the ownership, the isolation, et cetera. I think when we get a family dynamic even more ingrained in the circumstances, we not only are, you know, pulling up and looking under the rock of mom, but we're looking under the rock of Johnny as well, and all the other dynamics that have gone on for a lifetime. And far be it from us to, I'll often say to families, you know, if we're going to upheaval and make changes for mom, you need to realize that Johnny's going to have a trickle down effect. And what's your plan for Johnny?
Yeah. And is Johnny a bad guy? What do you guys think? I hear attorneys and people say, oh, failure to thrive kid or whatever. What is your thought on that? Is he a bad guy? Is he taking advantage?
What about the aspect of enabling?
I was just going to say he's been enabled his whole life. So, I mean,
mom wanted it, don't you think?
Exactly. So technically, I mean, she's done what she's wanted to do and cared for her son the way she's wanted. Poor choice, or?
Well, what could be the reasons why mom instinctively knew that Johnny needed to be taken care of?
Could it be that, you know, when she was, you know, bringing up Johnny, number one, he could be the only child. Number two, he could be, you know, somehow in her mind, incapable of, you know, thriving him, you know, in the world. So she took it upon herself as a, you know, it's her moral responsibility as a motherly person. It's her responsibility to take care of her child. Whether or not this child is going to reciprocate and take care of mom is a whole different story.
But is living with mom her security and prevention of isolation for herself? You know, we see it as he's not, you know, I mean, the fact that he's physically there might be enough for mom.
Lot of emotional, you know, like it's emotional knots, so to speak.
Right. What if Johnny has undiagnosed mental health issues? What if he has undiagnosed learning disabled? Johnny's 60 years old now. Do you think the school was helping out much? What if he's on the spectrum? And do you think a mom would know instinctively? So she was harder on Sarah and Gail than she was on Johnny.
So good, Leanne. Because this happens. So, I mean, this is life,
so
right?
Often.
This is so
Thank
good.
You, Jennifer.
I was going to say, Leanne, I feel like you've broken some laws by reading our files. I think you've broken into. I would argue the point. Everyone brought up excellent points. Is that mom has enabled son his whole life? So how do you come in and say, hey, wait, this is obviously what she wanted. So now do we honor what she wanted? But oftentimes I think to Leanne's point is that the relationship changes. Now Johnny's not just, you know, mom used to draw some boundaries, probably not great boundaries, but on the money or what his duties were around the house. But as she becomes disabled, now he is in charge of the cooking, the cleaning, possibly the caring for her. And he may be taking over some of the money, and it's moving in different directions or faster than anybody wanted in the sister. And so I think, you know, as a care manager, I think Frances, Mary, she's on here as Mary Meir. Sorry. I know Mary Meir.
Oh, sorry.
I know she goes by Frances. to me, she goes by Frances. Maybe not to everybody else.
Okay. Sorry, Mary. I didn't know.
No. And so,
it's okay.
So I think, you know, some of the points that she was making was that, you know, I think our position is to understand that family dynamic and the history and the background and all of those players and help not only keep what mother wanted, which was maybe keep Johnny in the home, but get a fiduciary who can manage the money and keep the sister happy so that the money stops flowing in directions she doesn't want, but not kick Johnny out. But I think many times the knee-jerk reaction is that people come in and say, I have a plan, I know how to fix it. And we're really imposing our morals and you know, our ideals onto this
And that was my point, Byron, is that even by, you know, almost the what was the word that was used, enabling. It has a negative connotation. But what if Johnny is actually doing much better because of mom's intervention and involvement? You know, what if he'd been kicked to the curb at 22 or 20 or 18, would he have ended up on drugs because he was self-medication mode? Would he have been just totally depressed because he couldn't hold down a job? I guess I'm on my personal mission, you guys, sorry, but I just want people to think that he may not be a bad guy, even though the family says so. Because, you know, Sarah's the perfect child. She did everything right, went to college, has her, I don't know, her master's degree, whatever, and has a great job and a great family. But Johnny wasn't able to do that, perhaps. Maybe mom enabled him and maybe it made it worse. But maybe Johnny is living the best life he can live, that he's capable of living, without better intervention that wasn't available at the time. Well, maybe mom feels guilty, you know?
I think what our goal needs to be in that circumstance, and I agree with you, Byron, that we have to not impose our standards and our expectations, but neutralizing the situation and finding the balancing act in the situation. The good of one does not outweigh the good of many. So we look at Johnny and see what his needs are and how he complements mom, if that's feasible, and how mom is surviving and thriving in this situation, despite my two children better have gotten out there and kicked butt. That was my expectation. But that's my subset. That's my desire. That's my wish. So looking at all the players and trying to neutralize again, Sarah out there who is saying, but I had to work hard, but I had to accumulate, but I had to do all the work. And I think the important role that we play is not just for Johnny's mom, but for Johnny as well. That's when the family opens that door, they have asked not only to support mom, but they're also, and we need to articulate to them, you're asking for resolution for Johnny as well. Are you willing to accept what we recommend as the resolution for Johnny? And are there funds to do that?
So Gail, is that because Johnny and his well-being benefits our client's well-being? Because
I would hope so.
Don't judge me. Okay. But, you know, Johnny's not our client, you know, but we're looking at the whole picture and we want to see how things interact and how it affects our client.
But when we move Shirley to the facility on Medicaid or Medi-Cal, then the facility now becomes part of the equation of our client.
Right.
And does that benefit Shirley? Would we have been able to accommodate both equally as well and continue with Shirley's success by bringing Johnny into the equation? Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
We only have a couple more minutes, so I do want to make sure that we kind of help wrap this up. So I want to give Leanne, I will throw one bone to Abby, and not to make this is a terrible parallel, but when our clients have a dog, we fight for them to be able to keep their dog, because we know that the emotional benefit of taking care of, knowing that Fido is taken care of, I think that mom knowing, you know, she did her best to take care of Johnny, so we should do our best to help her do that as well. And I don't know what that looks like. I mean, staying in the house, not staying in the house, setting up a trust. I don't know.
I like that pun that you just made, Byron. You might have not meant to, but you said you're going to throw me a bone. And then
I did mean to make that pun. So thank you.
You're so funny.
I am. I'm punny. Okay. Let me hand it off to Leanne real quick. So we've got like a minute left.
Yeah. So 1 minute. So just to bear in mind that capacity comes at different levels, that it's not black and white. The thing I did not mention that I'll mention right now is be careful what you put in writing. I've seen a lot of emails go around that say so-and-so doesn't have capacity. That is a discoverable document. So if you end up the family ends up having some sort of trust and estate litigation, they're going to find your email where you said it. And you might not like being deposed because it's going to feel really uncomfortable because they're going to ask you, how did you know? What was your basis? What is your process for determining that? So please don't do it. Be very, very careful. Talk about the situation. Don't assume a diagnosis. And even when there's a diagnosis in the chart, just be a little careful because sometimes things got put in the chart because a family member kind of verbalized it and it just sort of kept on going. So there you go. So different ramifications of incapacity. You guys had great examples. And you also, Prachi, had great examples of who decides who has capacity and what kind of testing that we do. So thank you very much for thinking about this.
Thank you. We thank you. And thank you,
thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for leading us today. This was amazing.
You're welcome.
Great discussion, everybody.
Julie put in the chat, you know, we do have our CMC. We do have our ethics. I know she posted those. So as we talk, we do have our code of ethics. But she also said, you know, consider our kind of our buddy, our pals, the ALCA, the Aging Life Care Association, does have its conference coming up in sunny Orlando in April. As a past president of ALCA, I don't know that I have anything to gain, right? You won't pay me, will you? It's always, for any CMC, I promise you, I've missed one in 20 years. They're phenomenal. So
they're amazing. And you can earn up to 15 continuing education hours. So that's your pretty much, you know, 1 year of your stuff. So think about it.
Awesome. Yep. All right. Well, thank you again. And
thank you all. Thank you, Leanne, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.